Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Zenith Bank Group H1 2021 financial results conference call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions later during the conference. If you should need assistance during the call, please signal for an operator by pressing star then zero. Please note that this call is being recorded. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Ebenezer Onyeagu. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ebenezer Onyeagu, the Group Managing Director and Chief Executive of Zenith Bank. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this call, where we'll be throwing light and more light to the performance of the group for half year ended June 2021. Before we go on, I would like to introduce my colleagues who are also on the call with me. I have Dennis Olisah, Executive Director, Tope Fashionette, Executive Director, Henry Oro, Executive Director, Umar Shaibu, Executive Director. We have Felix Egbon, Mukhtar Adam, our CFO, Eugene Ewubo, Investor and Analyst Manager, and we also have Michael, who is also here. First and foremost, it's important for us to give you a bit of context regarding the events in the market that will help you analyze and appreciate the performance for the period under review. Within the period, the MPC held four meetings, i.e., January, March, May, and June, and within the period, all the monetary parameters were left unchanged. Monetary policy rate remained at 11.5%, with a symmetric corridor of +100 basis points and -100 basis points around the MPR. Cash reserve requirement ratio remained at 27.5%, while liquidity ratio continues to be maintained at 30%. Additionally, within the period, we've seen a slight improvement and growth in GDP, with GDP for second quarter printing at GDP grew by 2.01% in Q2, which is a pointer to the fact that the recovery process is beginning to gain traction. However, it's important to know that the growth we see or improvement in the GDP is being largely driven by non-oil sector, which includes trade, ICT, transport, agri, and manufacturing. With respect to inflation, we've also observed in the last 2 months inflation trending downwards. Inflation that peaked at about 18.7% as at the end of July, printed at 17.38%. Oil price has remained relatively stable with a marginal improvement, moving from $64.6 per barrel in Q1 to $71.9 per barrel in Q2. Nigerian foreign reserves as at August 19th, 2021 stood at $34.8 billion. We've also observed some key. It's important to note some key initiatives that have also defined the banking sector or continue to define the banking sector. There is the expected commencement of the proposed Central Bank of Nigeria Digital Currency Initiative. The expected date of commencement is October 1st, 2021. There is a stoppage of sales of foreign exchange to BDCs, as CBN noted concerns around the leakages and shortcomings with selling foreign exchange through the BDCs. Now with the new regulation, PTAs and BTAs are now being wholly administered by deposit money banks. We've also seen the commencement of the road infrastructure tax credit, which is also beginning to gain traction, and there's also the expected commencement of the 1.5 trillion InfraCo company that is being floated by Central Bank of Nigeria and the African Finance Corporation. These initiatives are expected to drive incremental business volume, especially in the construction subsector. We've also observed and seen significant improvement in the power sector as the willing buyer, willing seller initiative of the power reform has brought about improvement in the cash flow of the distribution companies and by extension, improvement in the payment for power supply to the distribution companies. Another important point to note is the signing of the Petroleum Industry Act. This is expected to bring a bit of respite to the host communities with respect to the activities of the oil sector. The other important point to mention is that it comes with a lot of fiscal incentives that is expected to drive the development of our gas business. And we believe that the act will lead to the improvement and growth in the gas business. And this is also to come with the unbundling of the NNPC to become to be run as a commercial entity. So we also see improvement in business volume expected to come from the commencement of the LNG Train 7 project, which is a project that is in several billions of dollars. Then the contracts have several contracts have been awarded for the rehabilitation of refineries. We believe that these developments will help improve the business environment in the country. The COVID is still very much with us. The Delta variant is there. And it's also important to know that another round of vaccination program is on. And we expect that for as long as this vaccination program is being intensively applied, that the rate of recovery and the spread of the rate of business recovery and reduction in the spread of COVID should be experienced in the market. On the whole, for the period under review, we recorded a 2.57 growth in profit before tax, moving from 114.1 billion to 107 billion. This is coming on the back of very strong liquidity and capital buffers. Our capital adequacy ratio currently stands at 22%, while our liquidity ratio stands at a whopping 70%, clearly far in excess of the minimum expected liquidity ratio of 30%. So I'll leave this CFO to further unpack the figures behind our performance, and hopefully we'll be able to throw more light as we take your questions as we move along. Thank you very much. Mukhtar?
Thank you very much, MDCEO. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for attending the conference call. As the MD has mentioned, our performance for half year 2021 shows a very promising end of year 2021. Our PBT increased by 3% from 114 billion to 117 billion within the period. The growth in PBT is largely due to growth in our non-interest income and significant drop in our interest expense. Our PAT increased by 2% from 104 billion to 106 billion. You would also realize in our half-year results that our gross earnings was flat year on year, largely due to the yield environment, which saw interest income dropping. So interest and similar income dropped from 217 to 204 within the period. This is largely due to the low yield environment. As a bank, we responded to the drop in interest income by repositioning our funding sources, our deposit mobilization strategy, and our treasury management to ensure that the drop in interest expense far outweighs the drop in interest income. So within the period, interest income dropped by 13 billion, while interest expense dropped by 15.5 billion. Therefore, we ended up with a positive net interest income growth. The drop in interest expense has helped our cost of funds to drop to 1.3% from 2.2% last year. The result also shows impairment charge during the period decreased by 4.1 billion. That's 17% decrease, largely due to the improvement in the operating and yielding environment when compared to the highly tensed COVID environment of 2020. Non-interest income is a very major growth for us within the period. Overall, non-interest income grew by 9% from 116 billion to 127 billion. But the interesting aspect of the growth in net interest income is the growth of our fees and electronic products, which indicates the strength of Zenith Bank within the retail space and the benefit of our continuous investment in the digital channels as well as technology. This is very important if you look at the top line. The top line shows a flat growth, no growth, very flat. But if you analyze the top line with the growth in our non-interest income, you would realize a very impressive revenue-based diversification, which is very, very critical for us as a bank. Our OPEX increased by 10%, largely due to inflationary pressure. Inflation averages around 17%, but we managed to carefully ensure that our OPEX does not grow as fast as inflation. You also note that about half of our operating expense are related to regulatory charge, AMCON, NDIC. Okay? Our cost-to-income ratio within the period was 56%. But this has to be looked at within the context of half year. By the time we go to the full year, when we do not have to charge for AMCON, we will see cost-to-income ratio moderating to below 50%. Return on asset and return on equity also dropped. We closed return on asset on, and return on equity. Return on equity was 18.8% from 21%. Return on asset also dropped by 2.5%, largely due to the following. One, the yield environment that affected the interest income. Second, growth in our capital base. We have a very strong and robust capital base, which is very necessary when you consider the volatile global operating environment and a relatively more volatile local operating environment. So our capital base is a strength for us, although it mutes the growth in our return on equity. The growth in the size of our assets also affected the return on assets. But that's not something to worry about. By the time we finish the year end, we are going to level these parameters up. Our earnings per share grew to 3.3%. To 3.38% from 3.30%. So you can see that despite the challenging global operating environment, we have demonstrated resilience by reorganizing our balance sheets, our cost heads, our income heads, to come out with a growth in our bottom line, which we are going to continue in the second half of the year. I need not mention so much about the balance sheet of Zenith Bank, which is clear that it's a very strong balance sheet, very robust balance sheet, and highly liquid balance sheet. If you look at the customer deposit, has grown by 8% year on year. Interest expense has dropped. So that is to show you the depth of our banking knowledge in managing our balance sheet. We also want to note that our NPL ratio has been very stable at 4.5%. Liquidity ratio is almost 70%. So this shows that with a very strong, formidable and liquid balance sheet, very strong capital base, the group, Zenith Group, is in a very, very good position to continue our forward march to deliver excellent results to our shareholders and other stakeholders. So we are looking forward to an interesting 2021 financial year end. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, CFO. So we can now take your questions and comments.
Thank you. For the participants that dialed in, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone or on the keypad on your screen. If you decide to withdraw the question, please press star then two to remove yourself from the list. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one. We will pause to see if there are any questions. The first question comes from Damilola Olupona from Chapel Hill Denham. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the presentation. I would like to ask the following questions. I noticed that on a year-on-year basis, impairment charge was low. But however, impairment charges jumped more than threefold in Q2 2021. I don't know. I would like you to expatiate further on that. And secondly, as well, the CFO mentioned that interest expense was low. Yes, it was low on a half-year basis, but also quarter-on-quarter as well. We saw a jump in interest expense. Can you just provide context around that? And finally, my last questions would be around your restructured loans. I see here that more than 60% of your FCY loans have been restructured, and a large chunk of it comes from the oil and gas books. Can you just provide context as to how the restructuring is going? Just provide context on how the restructuring is going, and what the outlook for your loan book is, particularly in the oil and gas space. Is there a possibility that we see deterioration in that space? And what's the timeline in terms of CBN's moratorium guide? What's the timeline for that? Is it over a one-year period? And that will be my question for now.
Okay, thank you very much, Damilola. I think I'll start from the last question. Your concern is on the restructured loan, the FCY, the fact that about 60% of that is from the oil and gas sector. That is correct. Because if you look at the exposure we have in FCY loan, you dimension them into two main buckets. You have the oil and gas loan, because strictly in line with the regulation, we only create exposures for dollar loans for only companies that have the capacity to generate dollar cash flow. That's one. The second bit that you see are trade-related. The trade-related are not restructured because the bulk of our exposure in FCY are in foreign currency. That is why you see that a significant part of it is now, that 60% of it is what you see in the oil and gas sector. And let me say that the oil and gas sector in Nigeria, the challenge we have is not about production capability. It's more around the fact that we've been depending on very decaying and old infrastructure to evacuate production from the various wells to the terminals. The most prominent one is the Nebe Creek trunk line, which is as old as the discovery of oil and gas in the country. That's over how many years? It's older than me. So that particular pipeline has been thoroughly vandalized. So as a result, the operators are not able to, even when they produce, they shut in production. So what you see is that most of the operators we have, everybody is focusing on building alternative pipeline. So we expect that towards the end of the year, there will be commissioning of, a number of them will be commissioning alternative pipeline so that they can easily and very confidently evacuate their production. So once we have that, we think normalcy will return to that sector. Secondly, the signing of the Petroleum Industry Act is supposed to bring also respite in terms of the engagement of the stakeholders with the host communities. So we expect that respite will return. We also expect that with all that happening, these are positive sentiments that should boost production in that sector. So do we expect a deterioration? The answer is no. We don't expect deterioration. Maybe uniquely to Zenith. Uniquely to Zenith in the sense that the portfolio we have in the oil and gas space, these are all brownfield assets with very prolific reserve and proven reserves. And even before the shutting occurred, we had all of them producing at very remarkable and comfortable level to guarantee effective cash flow to service. So once we deal with the issue of the pipeline, we will say that 95% of the challenge we have in that sector as it relates to our books will be dealt with. You talk about the low impairment charge. I think I'll get the CFO to expatiate on that, but let me say that 2020 and 2021 are two uniquely different years. In 2020, at the outbreak of the COVID, there were a lot of concerns. Nobody, at this time last year, we had no idea of when vaccine would be ready. And as a result, we had to take, in line with our very conservative and prudent approach to treatment of loan, we had to ensure that we increase our impairment charge. But with the vaccination program coming in and the normalcy returning, we don't see any, and we've also seen businesses, the way they recover, we've seen that the impact of the COVID is not as severe as we thought it. As a result, we have to now review the kind of impairment charge we took last year. So what we've done is conservatively in line with our normal prudential guideline to risk minimization and control. So Mokhtar will throw more light on that. Low interest expense, quarter and quarter jump. Yes, quarter and quarter jump, you will see. If you look at it, that quarter and quarter jump, you are going to see that it is related to maybe a bit of the purchase funds. And let me say that it's important to appreciate the fact that 75% of our deposit is constituted in the CASA base, the current account and savings, and these are low costs. And overall, year on year, cost of funds were 2%, but as at end of this year, that's June, as at June 2020, our cost of funds was 2%. But as at end of June this year, our cost of funds has trended down to 1.3%. That's a remarkable saving. So what you see there is just a line item which is not related to the entire portfolio. The focus still remains savings and current account drive. And what is pushing that savings and current account drive? Do we expect it to continue? Yes. As we get deeper and bigger in the retail and digital space, we think we're in a position to create a lot more deposit. And this deposit, with the level of service we provide, with our ability to deal with chargeback and complaints and dispense error much faster than the industry in the digital space, we stand the chance of having a lot more sign-on and of scaling with respect to the growth in our retail deposit. So I'll leave Mokhtar to address, if there's other things I haven't addressed, the CFO can address it. Mokhtar?
Okay, thank you, MD. I think you've addressed, what I would add is, normally you shouldn't expect quarter on quarter. You shouldn't expect a straight line amount of impairment charge. So what we are reporting as impairment is based on IFRS. And when you're looking at IFRS, you do forward looking of a lot of macroeconomic variables. So at any point in time, the projection of the macros at that particular point in time can significantly affect the impairment charge that you are taking. So we have seen that in the first quarter, there was really a lot of hope of recovery. Somewhere in the second quarter, we started hearing the Delta variants, we started hearing whatever. So those are the things, the projections around macros can change at any point in time. And for us, we have to respond and use the appropriate and the latest available macro projections to determine our impairment charge. So what we have done is in line with the latest available macros projections using our model to determine the impairment. So going forward, don't expect a straight line charge on impairment. It could fluctuate depending on the environment and the projections. Thank you.
Okay, next question.
I just want to check, Damilola, does that answer all your questions?
Yes, it does for now. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Ronak Gardia from EFG Hermes. Please go ahead, Ronak.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the presentation and taking the time to take my questions. Two or three questions. Firstly, just to follow up on the provisions question that Mukhtar just answered. You know, we get, you know, the provisioning levels could change depending on the macroeconomic projections. However, if I look at disclosures provided by the bank, it seems a large amount of provisioning went into stage two provisions. So your stage three provisions are on a quarter-on-quarter basis seems to have increased. And it is my understanding, you know, that is largely driven by specific deterioration in loans rather than macroeconomic factors. So maybe you could just maybe explain that discrepancy. The second question was on your growth outlook. If I look at it on a year-on-year basis, you know, loan growth seems to be quite tepid. So if you could just maybe talk about what we should expect through the rest of the year. And maybe going into 2022 as well, assuming, you know, the macro environment doesn't change significantly, either positively or negatively from where we are at current levels. And then the third question, I guess, is a bit more broadly, I guess, very early days with regards to the e-Naira and digital currency. But it would be nice to hear your thoughts on what the disruptive impact of this currency could be. Could we see a big proportion of deposits leaving the system at the same time? Could we also see a big proportion of transactions moving to an alternative platform, which is what, you know, ideally could happen given how these currencies are being structured? So,
okay, thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much. The e-Naira, like we stated, is early days. The engagements are on. Essentially, what you see is that is going to be running on a blockchain technology, which will be anchored directly by the central bank, and it will also involve the creation of e-wallet. It's basically you doing having a digital currency, more like you operating. It's still part of the core of digital banking. So you now have your wallets created in digital format, which is still held and controlled and managed by the central bank, running under the blockchain technology. The engagements are on. We are involving all the stakeholders. We'll have a couple of meetings, and the stakeholders involve the telcos, the merchants, the fintechs, the deposit money banks, the microfinance bank. It's expected that this will also help to deepen the payment system and also accelerate the financial inclusion agenda of the central bank. And there are also concerns and discussions around the security framework that will be involved. So all that is being put together. Hopefully, between now and the commencement date, if that date is still respected, we expect a lot to happen and the market will be updated as events unfold. Growth outlook. First is to say that Zenith comes with very strong ethos. We come with strong ethos and discipline. And what I have seen occupying the role and the seat of the CEO is defending those ethos and discipline and culture leads to the creation and building of new competencies and capability. So just by us doing what we are, by us upholding the legacy and the culture of the institution, it creates an enormity of efficiency. It creates a new vista. It opens up creativity in us. So even if the market remains the way it is, what we know is that the response will be that we have to continue to be creative. And this creativity will focus more on building efficiency in our operations. And we believe that the more efficiency we build into our operation, making use of digital technology, the greater the savings will be. And once we have that savings, it will help us to improve our bottom line. But in terms of speaking to key issues in the environment, one thing is certain. The fact that, one, the vaccine campaign is on now. We've just received another set of vaccination and the vaccine, and the process is ongoing. The more people we have vaccinated, the better it is for everyone, and the more confidence you create in the system for activities and markets to thrive. Two, we've seen improvement coming from FMCGs. Mark you, this country is a country of 200 million people. 200 million people means 200 mouths to feed, 200 people to clothe, 200 people to provide medical facilities for, 200 people to provide utility services for. How do you define the market? A market is defined by number. So that tells you that Nigeria remains a big market. For as long as we are not in a lockdown, we expect that things will pick up, but cautiously too. We are not optimistic that the banks will return to the economy within the next 2 quarters. But we think the steady growth will continue, and the sentiment that leads us to that is the fact that we've seen the GDP improvement, even though it's tepid. We've also seen inflation receding. And we've also seen new incentives being driven by the central bank to improve the flows of foreign exchange into the economy. The federal government is about to launch a Eurobond program, which is expected to raise between $3 to $6 billion. That will help improve our foreign reserve and, by extension, improve what we have, the availability of dollars to meet our trade transactions. So, in a way, we'll say that, yes, for as long as we continue to be who we are, that is Zenith, defending the brand, we'll find the opportunity to scale up. Second, the other point is the digital and retail banking, the audacity and intensity with which we are pursuing it. I don't see anything stopping us from growing in that space. Mark you, digital and retail banking income, year on year, we grew by 91%. That is no mean achievement. And it didn't come out of nothing. It came from deliberate, comprehensive focus and strategy and execution to grow that space. And we see that if you look at number of accounts open, look at number of the volume of transactions going through our channels, and you also look at number of agents we have onboarded. So it gives you an indication of the growth trajectory that we are currently having and which we expect to sustain in our retail banking campaign. These are, Matthew, this is a tough environment. It's quite tough. We agree with that, but we just realize that being who we are, defending our name and our legacy, puts us in that situation where we keep finding opportunities to build capabilities that are proprietary to us. State two professional books, I want to speak to that.
Okay. Thank you, Ronald, for the question. Yes, you're right. The impairment charge for the stage two increased, but you also have to look at the increase, not necessarily because of further deterioration. So, as I explained earlier, when you have the same loan, the same customer is in stage two, the same business, when the macros don't look favorable, then the expected cash flow from that customer would also not look favorable. So therefore, your model will tell you how much you can recover from that customer is lower than how you projected previously. So the difference means you have to take higher impairment charge. In the same way, when the macro starts looking up and it is now pointing to the direction that the customer is in a better position to generate more cash flows due to increase in business activities, the economy is opening and everything, then your projected cash flows from the customer that you use to recover the loan will improve. That means your recoverable amount will be higher. So therefore, your impairment charge has to be lower than you projected. So that is the way that even stage two loans are affected by the macros and projections and other things. It does not mean additional loans have come in, or it does not mean a further deterioration. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If I could just ask one more follow-up question. The MD mentioned, you know, the increase in volumes of on electronic banking transactions, and the increased disclosures on this segment are appreciated. And it's quite remarkable to see the growth on a year-on-year basis. However, you know, when I compare your numbers that you published, and I appreciate this might not be like for like or apples to apples, but if I look at the numbers that Zenith is publishing, for example, on USSD, in the first 6 months, Zenith did about 250 million transactions. And that seems a lot lower than what some of the other peer banks are doing in the industry. So could you just talk about why Zenith's numbers are so much lower, and what steps the bank might be taking to close that gap?
Okay, thank you very much. You see, I think what needs to appreciate will be the channels. We don't compete at the same level on the same channels. So if you look at the channels, you look at our internet banking and mobile banking, you are going to notice, especially mobile banking, significant growth in volume. So if you go by that, you won't get the number. And beside that, the USSD volume, bear in mind that we got into retail much later than others who have gone ahead of us. If you watch the growth rate, if you do, in terms of absolute number, the onboarding, you are going to get something different. If you also look at the agency banking and do the number, I think if we look at the number in terms of number of agents and the transaction volume, when we ended last year, I think we were like number six, but at the last year, at about September, we were like number six, but by end of last year, we were number three. And we expect that hopefully before the end of this year, we should change position upwards anyway. So it's about the segment where you play. It's also about what is driving your own volume. So the USSD is there. Are there opportunities to scale? Yes, there are opportunities to scale. There are opportunities to scale, but we are happy at what we see, the volume we see growing a lot more from the mobile banking. But these are areas, or what, if, another way to look at it is, if you compare our numbers to that, the indication that gives us is, look, we have substantial room here in terms of growth. Yeah, talk about.
Okay, thank you. If you look further at the presentation on page 33, it's very clear there. You can see the growth across the channels on internet banking, mobile banking, and USSD, and agency banking. And let me say that what drives the income and transactions on channels is basically your customer onboarding. And that's one area we have focused on. We have continued to leverage on technology to expand our footprint in respect of onboarding of customers. Last for half year 2021, we increased our customer base by about 66%. That we added about 2.5 million customers, retail customers, in just 6 months. That will tell you that this will drive all the channel transactions, because as we open this account, we'll enroll them on the channels, on USSD, enroll them on mobile and on other channels. Then we drive the transactions. We drive the usage of these channels. We drive the card usage, and this all drives the income that we'll make for electronic products. So we are confident that these numbers will continue to go up relative to competition. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Jerry Nebue from Cardinal Stone. Please go ahead.
Thank you, good afternoon. So I just have a follow-up question. Again, still on your banking business, but especially in light with what the previous caller asked, with respect to INER. Now, I understand that this is a critical aspect of your strategy in the last couple of years, deepening retail penetration. But with what we're hearing concerning INER, especially as far as it concerns transaction costs, your likelihood that it's going to come at zero transaction costs. So to what extent do you think that could cannibalize on, you know, the strategy you already have? You know, how would it impact business going forward? Like you said before, it's still early days, but are you thinking about that? Is there a concern on that front? Secondly, I would like if you could give, you know, what your outlook is for the yield environment, seeing how it impacted interest income in the first half of the year. Thank you.
Okay, so I invite Sokwe to take on the question.
Okay, on the first bit, yes, transaction costs because of the INARA will, because we know that the MSC will be zero, some fees on the merchants will be zero. But nevertheless, it's still early days of the INARA. The launch is still about a month away. And don't forget that the first launch on INARA will focus on Tier 2 and Tier 3 when it comes to wallet creation. The Tier 1 is not yet part of it. A lot of the transactions you see, the income we see, comes from Tier 1. So, yes, there will be some bit of transaction reduction, fee reduction there, but overall, we'll always be innovative and creative to find a way to mitigate this this gap. Recall that 2 years ago, Central Bank reduced the fee on electronic banking across board, and you can see the response from the bank by increasing volume. So basically, volume increase is the way forward. We don't see all transactions moving to the e-Naira. Yes, some may move, but it's still early days.
Yes, let me add further that in terms of the e-Naira, let's bear in mind that we live in an environment where digital literacy is very high. So, digital literacy is low, I'm sorry. So, with what we see, even in terms of the onboarding, you are not going to see so much, you know, we don't see so much happening immediately. And the e-Naira too is going to come with its own unique challenges. But however, should it begin to impact costs, it would not be the first time we come across such a situation. 2 years ago, Central Bank came out and reduced transaction fees on different retail and electronic products by an average of about 50-60%. Again, like Tokwe mentioned, the focus of the e-Naira is not the high-value transaction, but the basic account, the Tier 1 account. There's a limit of what you can do there. You can't, if you want to buy maybe an electronic item worth 400,000, you can't do that with e-Naira, based on the limits of the transaction. So it's just as the way we see the e-Naira is something that will evolve over time. And until such a time when we build up scale in terms of dealing with the downside part of it here, cyber issues and cyber crime, and where we would have tested the technology, saying that, yes, the blockchain is working and is effective, I think it will still take a long time before you see substantial volume passing through there. The yield environment. Yes. See, what is the outlook? I think we'll say whatever it is that the market presents, one thing we know is that nobody has ever promised a better tomorrow. The only thing we can do is navigate and adapt to whatever we see the market present. We have no crystal ball to look in and tell you what the yield environment would be. All we'll do is that whichever direction it goes, we'll play the market. Should we see a situation where the yield environment deteriorates further, we know that it's a challenge for us to push down the cost of funds. So our response will just be whatever the market presents, we will play it.
Okay, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, just another reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. The next question comes from Ope Ani from Coronation Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the presentation. So the last conversation that we had, this was in sometime in Q2. You mentioned that you had started repricing loans at the end of Q1. So is the pass-through of this fully reflected in interest income for the Q2 numbers, or are we likely to see some improvements in Q3? And then my next question is, congrats on the reduction in cost of funds, quite laudable. So going forward, what is your view on spreads for H2? And then my final question is on loan growth. So you've guided to about 10% loan growth this year, but that has been quite tepid at just 2.5%. So what should we expect for H2? More aggression, or should, you know, our expectations be much lower?
Okay, thank you very much. Well, Dennis will take on the first question. And the second one, I think we lost you. It wasn't that audible. Then the third one is on the loan growth, whether we are changing our guidance. We are still in the race. We still have another 6 months to go, and we don't think there's any need to change our guidance. Dennis?
Thank you very much. On the pricing of loans, the truth is that we play this market, like the MD had said repeatedly. Don't forget that as an institution, we've always drawn our strength from the large corporates. You know, if you are dealing in the large corporate space, most often than not, you're a price taker. But to some extent, we are beginning to see improvements in our incursion in the retail space. That space, again, presents a different dimension as well as the dynamics as far as pricing is concerned. But please be rest assured, as a bank, whatever assets you give to us, we'll make sure that you get sufficient returns at the end of the year. Thank you.
Okay. Do you want to go to the second question? Because we didn't quite get that.
Yeah, the second question was, what is your view on spreads for H2?
Spread?
Yeah. Outlook on spreads for the bank.
Spread on what?
Your interest rates.
Oh, spread on the interest rates.
Yeah.
Okay. That's basically looking at it in terms of our net interest income, net interest margin. If you look at where it is now, again, it's coming back to the question you asked about where do we see the outlook in terms of the yield environment. You see, whatever it is, what is most important to us is efficiency. So it depends on what call we have to answer. We will not, in attempt to see that we increase the names, begin to book very, poor loan quality. We will not. If keeping the names very tight and if earning very narrow margin makes us sustain the loan quality, that's the option we'll go for. So we it's a margin business. Whatever it is, we will ensure that we don't make a loss. But we don't also compromise the loan book. We don't know what will happen tomorrow. We don't know what reforms that is expected from government. If tomorrow we face an environment where all of a sudden we see improved flows and supply into the market, the story will change completely. The story will change completely. The loan book is going to grow. So there are so many factors that will determine that. You have to look at availability of foreign exchange. You also have to consider, yes, the current hawkish approach of the regulators in managing CRR. So these are constraining factors that will not allow you to really exercise the kind of pricing you exercise. So in the midst of all that, we will navigate and ensure that we maintain a decent margin.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. The next question comes from Shaheen Barwani from Frontura Capital. Please go ahead, Shaheen.
Hello, it's actually Nick Paget with Frontura. Thank you for the call. I have two questions on foreign exchange. The first is, what rate do you translate your dollar assets to for balance sheet reporting purposes? And then my second question is on the FX backlog. And to be clear, I'm just asking about for equity investors, not for fixed income investors or for importers or other trade. So I guess I'm really asking any views you have on the outlook and to set the table. Really, the FX window for equity investors slammed shut in March of 2020, and very little, if any, dollars have flown to this group, you know, which comprise obviously the people on this call since then. So while we appreciate things like your steady stream of dividends, really they'll just go in the queue and that'll be the fourth dividend in a row that just sits there and we're unable to repatriate that money back to our home countries. So that's my question on, do you see what, you know, I recognize reserves will likely go above 40 billion with the euro bond and with the SDR allocation. But I'm just, I guess, doubtful if any of that money's ever going to go to the long suffering equity investors. And I wonder even if the bank might consider that is Zenith might consider doing something for its shareholders as a way to actually get dollars from the dividends that you so generously pay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Tahir. The second question, the CFO will answer the question with respect to rate of translation of our balance sheet. On the availability, the FS backlog, all we know is that CBN has been consistently selling money to the FPIs, where the equity investors fall into. CBN has been selling forests to them, and we are not in a position to confirm the volume of sales into the market, but we know that consistently they've been selling. That's the feedback we have there. When the euro bonds come in, and possibly the SDR, we can't confirm if the SDR is in. If you ask me, what's the expectation? The expectation is that there will be incremental allocation because the port is now fuller than what it used to be before. So will there be incremental allocation to clear the FPI and the backlog? My guess would be a yes. But in what quantum and how long will it take, we are not able to tell. So, Mukta, you want to answer on the rate of translation of balance sheets.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. The closing rate that we used for the balance sheet as of June 30, 2021 was 410. I believe that is what the whole banking industry or the whole markets will use. It's a standard rate that we use, and we have disclosed this fact in the financial statements. Within the period, the average rate was 407, and by the closing was at 410. So if you have a financial statement, you can check page 112, the very last paragraph there. We have explained these details there. Thank you.
With regard to the queue, you know, I guess I'm providing the feedback that while I know the central bank allocates dollars, none of that money is going to equity investors. It's going to fixed income investors, but it is not going to equity investors. And I think I probably speak on behalf of everyone on this call. You know, we know this because we have money sitting in the queue that sat there since March of 2020. And, you know, we're using the largest custodian in Nigeria, who's sub-custodian for the largest custodian in the world. So it's not like we're outside of mainstream in our experience. We have the most mainstream experience, and none of that money is flowing to equity investors. That's just the feedback I wanted to leave you with.
Okay, thank you for that. That's noted.
Thank you. I would just like to check with Ebenezer. Sir, due to time, are we able to take any questions or can we conclude, sir?
If there are more questions, we can take maybe one or two.
Okay. The next question comes from Abdul Aziz Bakari from Mainstream Capital. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. So, you talked about the lower cost of funds and your expectation to keep it low. So, I would like to ask, do you consider fintech as a threat to increase your CASA mix?
I think you need to understand the context of what a fintech does and where their pool of funds are sitting. A fintech is not a bank. Therefore, a fintech cannot hold deposits. A fintech holding deposits is holding it in the books of a bank. Either you are working as their settlement bank, or you are working holding the wallet account for those who operate wallet accounts. So, whatever it is they have, it sits with a bank. So, it sits with a bank. So, they are not competing with you. If you are, well, the flows will be going through them, but the flows still go through the deposit money banks who have the settlement platform for their transaction. Yeah, where do they constitute a disruption or a threat to us? Well, you can say, instead of you dealing with the, if you have the wallet account of, say, fintech, instead of you having the individual account of the wallet holder sitting with you, the individual wallet account are sitting with a fintech, but in aggregate with a bank. So if you have a fintech that has a billion naira in their consolidated wallet account belonging to different wallet holders, that money is sitting with a bank, not with any fintech. So, more or less, that's the concept. You see that when it comes to fintech, it's a two-pronged approach for us. We are competing, we are collaborating. It depends on what side, the perspective that is being presented to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The final question that we can take is from... is a follow-up question from Damilola. The next question is from Abdul Ralph Bello from WSTC Financial. Please go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Okay, so my question is on the retail banking of the group. So we all know that Zenith Bank is very strong on corporate lending and all. And based on what is on slide 31, I could see that of all the segments, the retail banking seems to be the only segment that grew as of H1. So I just want to get a sense of what retail banking is. What is the classification of retail banking, you know, in your perspective? Just want to get a sense of that. Thank you.
Okay, Tokwe and Henry will answer that.
Okay, thank you. Retail for us is a very major strategy going forward. Yes, we started out as a corporate bank, but we've always said that we are replicating the same leadership, the same strategy that we did on the corporate in the retail, where we expect to grow to be the leading retail bank in the industry. What are we doing? A lot is being done. Number one is, like I said before, customer onboarding. We're growing our customer base. We have a lot of channels that we use to onboard customers, from the obvious of the USSD to the web, wallets, the agency banking, internet banking. And of recent, we're adding more solutions. We are using technology to drive these processes. WhatsApp banking was the new addition we had it just about a week ago. Now you can open an account with WhatsApp. Then dispute resolution is a major way that has been helping us. We are very strong in that. Agency banking dispute, for example, is efficiently done. Now we have this, our virtual assistant, we just launched that, the Ziva, that can engage customers and resolve their issues, even without having to call our Zenith Direct. So you can see that we are coming up with various solutions. Even on agency banking, we have grown tremendously. With agents now at about 65,000 from where we started from, the transactions have doubled. If you look at the income from agency in the presentation, it's increased by 50%. In addition, the MD has mentioned the fintech collaboration in driving that retail process. It's all, everything that revolves around individuals and capturing their businesses, their payments, their transactions, their lifestyle. We are there. We are also coming out with different value propositions, you know, campaigns, promotion. These are areas that you don't see Zenith before, but we are there now because we understand that's what the market wants. That cuts across the students, the workers, the retail loans, you know, upselling to the our large corporate customers. And, you know, the sky's the limit. We can assure you that we'll continue to do better. Even wallets also. We're using wallet adoption, you know, for those that are not financially included, you know, because without BVN, you can open accounts with wallets. That is also driving our retail penetration. So that's what we're doing. I can assure you that the numbers will continue to grow. As you can see, contribution of retail segments to gross revenue, to PBT, all increased significantly in the presentation for the half year. So thank you very much.
Harry? All right, thank you, Abdi. Just also to add, because Tope has quite extensively explained this, how we're scaling on the retail. Part of your question was classification. What is our classification for retail and all that? but I'd like to tell you that whatever we're doing on retail, we're doing as much in the other space, in the corporate. You know, at the end of the day, it all reports to the balance sheet, it reports to the P&L. So beyond the channels, ATM, USSD, HSBC banking, POS, internet banking, and the mobile platforms that we have, let me say, in addition to all this, we have the global pay, we have the corporate internet banking, which are very robust channels to support our corporate business. So we have not left the corporate aside. As a matter of fact, we are using the retail to create channels to support the corporates. So the growth you see in the retail, as much growth you should also expect to see in the corporate moving forward. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Just be rest assured that it's a case of us using our corporate to flank our retail initiative.
Okay, thank you. The final question that we can take is from Toyosi Oni from Renaissance Capital. Please go ahead, Toyosi.
Hi, team, and thank you very much for hosting this call. I have a few questions, so I hope you're able to spare me a bit more time to run through my questions, as I had indicated on the call much earlier. So, the first question I have is on asset quality, and it's just, I guess, following up on some of the questions that have been asked earlier in relation to IFRS 9. So your Stage 3 loans actually increased 26% year-to-date. I just wanted to ask what was driving that, because that's a classification. So I just wanted to ask, away from the macro drivers, which specific loans went bad during the period. The next set of questions I have is on your trading gains. So in December 2020, you reported swap contracts of about 440 billion naira. In the June report that was recently published, this number doesn't come up again. And I just wanted to ask, if this was the case, shouldn't there be a reversal of some sort of the revaluation gains that were booked on that 440 billion in swaps last year? Again, in the report, we see that the table that shows your currency categorizations do not have a summation. So if we compute this manually, on my numbers, you might have different numbers. I've got a short position of 236 billion, which represents a short position of $574 million. I just wanted to ask how we could please reconcile this to the 12 billion in revaluation gains that you booked in this reporting quarter. And then just going forward, how do you see your derivative book evolving? Yields are declining. Forward rates are also weakening. What happens when these swaps expire? I think you've got about 66 billion of that on your balance sheet. And then just on your treasury bills held at fair value through profit and loss, you've got an amount of 725 billion. How much of this is marked to market? The next set of questions I have is on your net, your non-interest revenue. So you've got other operating income. You've got about dividend income from subsidiaries, which was 16.4 billion. I just wanted to get a sense of which subsidiary this came from. And On that line also, there was a 1.5 times year-on-year jump in your account maintenance fees. I understand that you onboarded a lot of customers in this period versus that period, but it's quite a significant jump. And seeing, you know, the slowdown in transactional activities, I mean, there's recovery, but it's not been, you know, that significant. Why was there such a jump on that line? My next question is on your tax rate. The tax rate was 5% in your second quarter. I just wanted to see what drove this. And then just looking forward, the tax holidays that the FG put on treasury instruments are expiring soon. If these are not renewed, what's going to be your effective tax rate in 2022? Then my last set of questions is on your digital strategy, which you've actually spoken very extensively about. On your transactional fees, especially on agency banking, we've seen a huge decline in take rates. Given the, and by take rate, I mean, you know, the fee you charge, your merchant discount rate, that fee that you charge on the agency banking. I just wanted to ask, we've seen a lot of competition in that space from both fintechs, from telcos, and these rates have been, it's almost as if it's a race to zero. How do you see that evolving? And then how many digitally active customers do you have, and how do you define a digitally active customer? Thank you very much, and I really hope my questions will be answered.
Chaos, to start with, we didn't hear you until towards the end. And it looks like you asked like about 50 questions in all. And out of which we could only hear you ask about why there's a jump in account maintenance. Asking me why there's a jump in account maintenance, you are asking me why I got better. I should get better. My improvement in account maintenance is just growth in business. Tax holiday on treasury bill, if a decision is taken, it's an industry position. Whatever the government comes up with, it doesn't apply to Zenith alone. All of us will embrace it as an industry. Digital strategy, I can't come in the open and tell you what my strategies are. All I will tell you is, we are driving the digital campaign with a lot of intensity. And you can see how that is resonating in the figures. I don't know if my colleague speaks to the other questions. Because
dividend from subsidiaries.
Okay, dividend from subsidiaries. Mukta, for those who have the other questions,
we can answer. The banking competition on our
okay. Let Mukta can answer the one he had, and others can answer the other questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Toyosi. Your questions, one, you asked about the asset quality on stage two loans, what caused the additional impairment charge. I think we've explained that it's not because of deterioration in the loans, it's because we have to project based on the macros and other parameters the expected cash flows from the customers. As parameters and operating environment are changing the expected cash flows, your recoverable amount in the model reduces. Therefore, you have to provide more. The other way around, if the cash flow is increasing based on your forecast, which is also driven by the macros and other parameters, then you have to take less. So if you see us taking less impairment, that is what is driving it. If you see us taking more impairment, that is what is driving it. That's number one. Number two, you made mention of trading gains, which has always been a strength for us. I don't know if you have had time to look at our notes on the trading gains. That's maybe, I think, you also made mention of our derivative books. We didn't show the swap position. I'm not too sure you looked at the page 110 of the financial statements, which we have clearly mentioned. We have a swap position with counterparties for nominal amount of 1.6 billion. And that is 682 billion. The 682 billion is receivable in treasury bills, which we have as part of our treasury bills asset. And we have to swap that with $1.6 billion on maturity. So on maturity of this asset, we return a naira assets in the form of treasury bills to the various counterparties, and we get a dollar asset. We get a dollar cash from the various counterparties of $1.6 billion. Then if you look at that note very well, the standard IFRS, what it requires you to do in that note is to show how we are managing our FX exposure. So what we have presented there is to say this is our asset in various currencies, and this is the liability that is generating the asset, and this is what we are managing. So I don't think there is any disclosure that is missing from there within the period. And then when you go back to the derivative books, you will see that the operating environment, i.e. the yield environment, has also affected the derivative books in terms of the valuation and in terms of the income. So you don't see significant jump in those line of income within the period. If you check that very well, I can refer you to the notes, page 146, note 11. You will see the various derivative books. In all, we have total derivative instruments, swaps, and other things totaling about $3 billion, which you will also see as we have appropriately disclosed them in our financial statements. So if you check page 151, you would also see that disclosures there. Non-interest revenue dividend from subsidiaries. Within the period, we have received dividend from Zenith Ghana and dividend from Zenith Bank UK. We have also received dividend from Zenith Pension. These are the three subsidiaries that have given us dividend within the period. You also mentioned of effective tax rates when the regulation changes. You and I, we are not very sure whether the regulation is going to change. Although the expiry date is end of the year, we want to see government's budget proposal and the finance act that they will come up with. But if you look at our tax reconciliation for the various notes on tax, you would realize that we have unutilized deferred tax assets. We have unutilized deferred tax assets that is almost $25 billion. Those are assets that can easily come in during the time that all these dispensations will cease to help us manage our effective tax rate. That has been a strategy that we have adopted from day one, very long-term tax management strategy that once this dispensation ends, it is going to come handy for us to manage our effective tax rate. So far, those are the questions that I've been able to hear. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Due to time, that is all that we can take. Ebenezer, can I hand back to you for closing comments?
Okay. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for the opportunity for us to throw more light into our performance and also give you insights on how we will possibly close the year. I can assure you that we will continue to ride the storms we see in the market, and we will ensure that we keep interrogating the market to find opportunities, and we have to keep rethinking and reimagining our business model in order for us to position ourselves for continued growth and offer differential and competitive advantage in the market. We believe strongly that how the COVID vaccination campaign succeed will help the entire global economy to recover effectively and for the business to come back to normalcy. But whatever it is, be rest assured that we'll continue to drive opportunities we see in very specific niche markets, niche advantages, and we still believe that the retail banking, the digital banking, will continue to be an area that will continue to upscale. We are making the right investment to upscale our digital and electronic and ICT platform to give us the enterprise architecture that is required to support our massive retail and digital campaign. So all said, We expect that by the end of the year, we should be able to post a decently respectable figure, and we don't think there's any need for us to review any of our guidance downwards. All we see is that the guidance we see, wherever we are with the guidance, no matter how far we are from the guidance, it also defines the required run rate expected of us to close the year effectively. So we thank you very much and urge everyone to continue to stay safe and be healthy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conference. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.